Here is an instance, drawn from Richard Dawkins' discussion of the curious case of the flatfish, flounders and soles, for instance, who, when they are born, are vertical fish, like herring or sunfish, but whose skulls undergo a weird twisting transformation, moving one eye to the other side, which then becomes the top of the bottom-dwelling fish. Why didn't they evolve like those other bottom dwellers, skates, which are not on their side but on their belly, like sharks that have passed under a steamroller? Dawkins, 1986A, page 91. Dawkins imagines a scenario on pages 92 to 93. Even though the skate way of being a flat fish might ultimately have been the best design for bony fish too, the would-be intermediates that set out along this evolutionary pathway apparently did less well in the short term than their rivals lying on their side. The rivals lying on their side were so much better in the short term at hugging the bottom. In genetic hyperspace, there is a smooth trajectory connecting free-swimming ancestral bony fish to flatfish lying on their side with twisted skulls. There is not a smooth trajectory connecting these bony fish ancestors to flatfish lying on their belly. There is such a trajectory in theory, but it passes through intermediates that would have been, in the short term, which is all that matters, unsuccessful if they had ever been called into existence. Does Dawkins know this? Does he know that the postulated intermediates were less fit? Not because he has seen any data drawn from the fossil record. This is a purely theory-driven explanation, argued a priori from the assumption that natural selection tells us the true story, some true story or other, about every curious feature of the biosphere. Is that objectionable? It does beg the question, but what a question it begs. It assumes that Darwinism is basically on the right track. Is it objectionable when meteorologists say, begging the question against supernatural forces, that there must be a purely physical explanation for the birth of hurricanes, even if many of the details so far elude them? Notice that in this instance, Dawkins' explanation is almost certainly right. There is nothing especially daring about that particular speculation. Moreover, it is, of course, exactly the sort of thinking a good reverse engineer should do. It seems so obvious that this General Electric widget casing ought to be made of two pieces, not three, but it's made of three pieces, which is wasteful and more apt to leak. So we can be damn sure that three pieces was seen as better than two in somebody's eyes, short-sighted though they may have been. Keep looking. The philosopher of biology, Kim Sterelny, in a review of The Blind Watchmaker, made the point this way. Dawkins is admittedly giving only scenarios, showing that it's conceivable that, for example, wings could evolve gradually under natural selection. Even so, one could quibble. Is it really true that natural selection is so fine-grained that, for a proto-stick insect, looking 5% like a stick is better than looking 4% like one? Pages 82 through 83. A worry like this is especially pressing because Dawkins' adaptive scenarios make no mention of the costs of allegedly adaptive changes. Mimicry might deceive potential mates as well as potential predators. Still, I do think this objection is something of a quibble because essentially I agree that natural selection is the only possible explanation of a complex adaptation. So something like Dawkins' stories have got to be right. Sterelny, 1988, page 424. 3. Playing with constraints. It is just as foolish to complain that people are selfish and treacherous as it is to complain that the magnetic field does not increase unless the electric field has a curl. John von Neumann, quoted in William Poundstone, 1992, page 235. As a general rule today, a biologist seeing one animal doing something to benefit another assumes either that it is manipulated by the other individual or that it is being subtly selfish. George Williams, 1988, page 391. One may nevertheless be reasonably nervous about the size of the role of sheer, unfettered imagination in adaptationist thinking. What about butterflies with tiny machine guns for self-protection? This fantastic example is often cited as the sort of option that can be dismissed without detailed analysis by adaptationists seeking to describe the ensemble of possible butterfly adaptations from which Mother Nature has chosen the best, all things considered. It is just too distant a possibility in design space to be taken seriously. But as Richard Lewontin, 1987, page 156, aptly notes, my guess is that if fungus-gardening ants had never been seen, the suggestion that this was a reasonable possibility for ant evolution would have been regarded as silly. Adaptationists are masters of the retrospective rationale, like the chess player who only notices after he's made the move that it forces checkmate in two moves. How brilliant! And I almost thought of it. But before we decide that this is a flaw in adaptationist character or method, we should remind ourselves that this retrospective endorsement of brilliance is the way Mother Nature herself always operates. Adaptationists should hardly be faulted for being unable to predict the brilliant moves that Mother Nature herself was oblivious of until she'd stumbled upon them. The perspective of game-playing is ubiquitous in adaptationism, where mathematical game theory has played a growing role ever since its introduction into evolutionary theory by John Maynard Smith, 1972 and 1974. Game theory is yet one more fundamental contribution to 20th century thinking from John von Neumann. Von Neumann created game theory in collaboration with the economist Oscar Morgenstern, and it grew out of their realization that agents make a fundamental difference to the complexity of the world. Whereas a lone Robinson Crusoe agent can view all problems as seeking stable maxima, hill climbing on Mount Fuji, if you like, as soon as other maxima-seeking agents are included in the environment, strikingly different methods of analysis are required. A guiding principle cannot be formulated by the requirement of maximizing two or more functions at once. One would be mistaken to believe that it can be obviated by a mere recourse to the devices of the theory of probability. Every participant can determine the variables which describe his own actions, but not those of the others. Nevertheless, those alien variables cannot, from his point of view, be described by statistical assumptions. This is because the others are guided, just as he himself, by rational principles, whatever that may mean, and no modus procedendi can be correct which does not attempt to understand those principles and the interactions of the conflicting interests of all participants. Von Neumann and Morgenstern, 1944, page 11. The fundamental insight that unites game theory and evolutionary theory is that the rational principles, whatever that may mean, that guide agents in competition can exert their influence even on such unconscious, unreflective semi-agents as viruses, trees, and insects, because the stakes and payoff possibilities of competition determine which lines of play cannot help winning or losing if adopted, however mindlessly they are adopted. The best-known example in game theory is the prisoner's dilemma, a simple two-person game which casts shadows, both obvious and surprising, into many different circumstances in our world. Here is the basic outline. Excellent detailed discussions of it are found in Poundstone, 1992, and Dawkins, 1989A. You and another person have been imprisoned, pending trial, on a trumped-up charge, let's say. And the prosecutor offers each of you, separately, the same deal. If you both hang tough, neither confessing nor implicating the other, you will each get a short sentence. The state's evidence is not that strong. If you confess and implicate the other, and he hangs tough, you go scot-free and he gets life in prison. If you both confess and implicate, you both get medium-length sentences. Of course, if you hang tough and the other person confesses, he goes free and you get life. What should you do? If you both could hang tough, defying the prosecutor, this would be much better for the two of you than if you both confess. So couldn't you just promise each other to hang tough? In the standard jargon of the prisoner's dilemma, the hang tough option is called cooperating. You could promise, but you would each then feel the temptation, whether or not you acted on it, to defect. Since then you would go scot-free, leaving the sucker, sad to say, in deep trouble. Since the game is symmetrical, the other person will be just as tempted, of course, to make a sucker of you by defecting. Can you risk life in prison on the other person's keeping his promise? Probably safer to defect, isn't it? That way, you definitely avoid the worst outcome of all, and might even go free. Of course, the other fellow will figure this out, too, if it's such a bright idea. So he'll probably play it safe and defect, too, in which case you must defect to avoid calamity unless you are so saintly that you don't mind spending your life in prison to save a promise breaker. So you'll both wind up with medium-length sentences. If only you could overcome this reasoning and cooperate. The logical structure of the game is what matters, not this particular setting, which is a usefully vivid imagination driver. We can replace the prison sentences with positive outcomes. It's a chance to win different amounts of cash or, say, descendants, just so long as the payoffs are symmetrical and ordered so that loan defection pays more than mutual cooperation, which pays each more than mutual defection does, which in turn pays more than the sucker payoff one gets when the other is a loan defector. And in formal settings, we set a further condition. The average of the sucker and mutual defection payoffs must not be greater than the mutual cooperation payoff. Whenever this structure is instantiated in the world, there is a prisoner's dilemma. Game theoretic explorations have been undertaken in many fields, from philosophy and psychology to economics and biology. The most influential of the many applications of game theoretic thinking to evolutionary theory is Maynard Smith's concept of an evolutionary stable strategy, or ESS, a strategy that may not be best from any Olympian or Fujian standpoint, but is unimprovable upon and unsubvertible under the circumstances. Maynard Smith, 1988, especially chapters 21 and 22, is an excellent introductory account of game theory in evolution. The revised edition of Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene, 1989a, has a particularly good account of the development of ESS thinking in biology during the last decade or so, when large-scale computer simulations of various game-theoretic models revealed complications that had been overlooked by the earlier, less realistic versions. I now like to express the essential idea of an ESS in the following more economical way. An ESS is a strategy that does well against copies of itself. The rationale for this is as follows. A successful strategy is one that dominates the population. Therefore, it will tend to encounter copies of itself. Therefore, it won't stay successful unless it does well against copies of itself. This definition is not so mathematically precise as Maynard Smith's, and it cannot replace his definition because it is actually incomplete. But it does have the virtue of encapsulating, intuitively, the basic ESS idea. Dawkins, 1989a, page 282. There can be no doubt that game theoretic analyses work in evolutionary theory. Why, for instance, are the trees in the forest so tall? For the very same reason that huge arrays of garish signs compete for our attention along commercial strips in every region of the country. Each tree is looking out for itself and trying to get as much sunlight as possible. If only those redwoods could get together and agree on some sensible zoning restrictions and stop competing with each other for sunlight, they could avoid the trouble of building those ridiculous and expensive trunks, stay low and thrifty shrubs, and get just as much sunlight as before. Dennett, 1990B, page 132. But they can't get together under these circumstances. Defection from any cooperative agreement is bound to pay off if ever or whenever it occurs, so trees would be stuck with the tragedy of the commons. Hardin, 1968. If there weren't an essentially inexhaustible supply of sunshine. The tragedy of the commons occurs when there is a finite public or shared resource that individuals will be selfishly tempted to take more of than their fair share, such as the edible fish in the oceans. Unless very specific and enforceable agreements can be reached, the result will tend to be the destruction of the resource. Many species, in many regards, face various sorts of prisoner's dilemmas, and we human beings face them both consciously and unconsciously, sometimes in ways that we might never have imagined without the aid of adaptationist thinking. Homo sapiens is not exempt from the sort of genetic conflict David Haig postulates to explain genomic imprinting. In an important new article, 1993, he analyzes a variety of conflicts that exist between the genes of a pregnant woman and the genes of her embryo. It is in the embryo's interests, of course, that the mother bearing it stay strong and healthy, for its own survival depends on her not only completing her term of pregnancy, but tending for her newborn. However, if the mother, in her attempt to stay healthy under trying circumstances, famine, for instance, which must have been a common circumstance in most generations of human existence, should cut down on the nutrition she provides her embryo, at some point this becomes more of a threat to the embryo's survival than the alternative, a weakened mother. If the embryo were given a choice between being spontaneously aborted early in the pregnancy or being stillborn or of low birth weight on the one hand, versus being born at normal weight of a weak or even dying mother on the other, what would selfish reason dictate? It would dictate taking whatever steps are available to try to ensure that the mother does not cut her losses. She can always try to have another child later when the famine is over, and this is just what the embryo does. Both embryo and mother can be entirely oblivious of this conflict, as oblivious as the trees rising competitively in the forest. The conflict plays out in the genes and their control of hormones, not in the brains of mother and embryo. It is the same sort of conflict we saw between maternal and paternal genes in the mouse. There is a flood of hormones. The embryo produces a hormone that will enhance its own growth at the expense of the mother's nutritional needs. Her body responds with an antagonist hormone that attempts to undo the effects of the first, and so on, in an escalation that can produce hormone levels many times higher than normal. This tug of war usually ends in a mutually semi-satisfactory standoff, but it produces a host of byproducts that would be utterly baffling and senseless were they not the predictable effects of such conflict. Haig concludes, with an application of the fundamental game theoretic insight, maternal and fetal genes would both benefit if a given transfer of resources was achieved with a lesser production of hormones and less maternal resistance, but such an agreement is evolutionarily unenforceable. Haig, 1993, page 518. This is not, in many regards, welcome news. Von Neumann's all-too-casual remark on the inevitability of human selfishness epitomizes the Darwinian mindset that many people view with loathing, and it is not hard to see why. They fear that Darwinian survival of the fittest would entail that people are nasty and selfish. Isn't that just what von Neumann is saying? No, not quite. He is saying that it is indeed entailed by Darwinism that such virtues as cooperation should be, in general, evolutionarily unenforceable, and hence hard to come by. If cooperation and the other unselfish virtues are to exist, they must be designed. They do not come for free. They can be designed under special circumstances. See, for instance, Eschel, 1984, 1985, and Haig and Grafen, 1991. After all, the eukaryotic revolution that made multicelled organisms possible was a revolution that began when an enforceable truce was somehow engineered between certain prokaryotic cells and their bacterial invaders. They found a way of joining forces and submerging their selfish interests. Cooperation and the other virtues are, in general, rare and special properties that can only emerge under very particular and complex R&D circumstances. We might contrast the Panglossian paradigm, then, with the Pollyannian paradigm, which cheerfully assumes, with Pollyanna, that Mother Nature is nice. In general, she isn't, but that isn't the end of the world. Even in the present case, we can see that there are other perspectives to adopt. Aren't we really rather fortunate, for instance, that trees are so insuperably selfish? The beautiful forests, to say nothing of the beautiful wooden sailing ships and the clean white paper on which we write our poetry, could not exist if trees weren't selfish. There can be no doubt, as I say, that game theoretic analyses work in evolutionary theory. But do they always work? Under what conditions do they apply, and how can we tell when we are overstepping? Game theory calculations always assume that there is a certain range of possible moves, from which the selfish by definition contestants make their choices. But how realistic is this in general? Just because a move in a particular circumstance is the move that reason dictates, is it the move nature will always take? Isn't this Panglossian optimism? As we have just noted, this sometimes looks more like Panglossian pessimism. Darn, organisms are too smart to cooperate. The standard assumption of game theory is that there will always be mutations that have the right phenotypic effects to rise to the occasion. But what if the right move just doesn't occur to Mother Nature? Is this ever or often very likely? We certainly know of cases in which Mother Nature does take the move, to make the forests, for instance. Are there perhaps just as many or more cases in which some sort of hidden constraint prevents this from happening? There may well be. But in every such case, adaptationists will want to persist by asking the next question. And is there a reason in this case why Mother Nature doesn't take the move? Or is it just a brute, unthinking constraint on Mother Nature's rational gamesmanship? Gould has suggested that a fundamental flaw of adaptationist reasoning is the assumption that in every fitness landscape, the way is always shown as clear to the tops of the various summits. But there might well be hidden constraints, rather like railroad tracks lying across the landscape. The constraints of inherited form and developmental pathways may so channel any change that even though selection induces motion down permitted paths, the channel itself represents the primary determinant of evolutionary direction. Gould, 1982A, page 383. Populations, then, do not get to spread ad lib across the terrain, but are forced to stay on the tracks. Suppose this is true. Now, how do we locate the hidden constraints? It is all very well for Gould and Lewontin to point to the possibility of hidden constraints. Every adaptationist already acknowledges this as an omnipresent possibility. But we need to consider what methodology might be best for discovering them. Consider a curious variation on a standard practice in chess. When a stronger player plays a weaker opponent in friendly matches, The stronger player often volunteers to take on a handicap to make the game more evenly matched and exciting. The standard handicap is to give up a piece or two, to play with only one bishop or one rook, or, in a really extreme case, to play without a queen. But here is another handicapping system that might have interesting results. Before the match, the stronger player writes down on a piece of paper a hidden constraint, or constraints, that she will undertake to play under, and hides the paper under the board. Was it the difference between a constraint and a forced move? Reason dictates a forced move, and will always dictate it again and again, whereas some frozen bit of history dictates a constraint, whether or not there was a reason for its birth, and whether or not there is a reason for or against it now. Here are a few of the possible constraints. Unless I am forced by the rules to do so, because I am in check and am obliged to play whatever legal move escapes check, 1. I may never move the same piece on 2 consecutive turns. 2. I may not castle. 3. I may capture with pawns only 3 times in the whole game. 4. My queen must move only in rook fashion, never diagonally. Now imagine the epistemological predicament of the weaker player, who knows his opponent is playing with hidden constraints, but doesn't know what they are. How should he proceed? The answer is quite obvious. He should play as if all the apparently possible moves, all the legal moves, are available to her, and adjust his strategy only when evidence begins to mount that she is actually bound not to take what otherwise would be the obviously best move. Such evidence is not at all easy to gather. If you think your opponent cannot move her queen diagonally, you might test that hypothesis by the risky tactic of offering a free capture to that queen on the diagonal. If the queen declines, that counts in favor of your hypothesis, unless there is a deeper reason of strategy, unimagined as yet by you, for declining the capture. Remember Orgel's second rule: evolution is cleverer than you are. Of course, another way of learning the hidden constraints at the chessboard is to peek at the paper. And one might think that what Gould and Lewontin are recommending is that adaptationists simply abandon their game playing and go for the truth via a more direct examination of the molecular evidence. Unfortunately, this analogy is mistaken. You are certainly entitled to use whatever data gathering tricks are available in the game of science. But when you peek at the molecules, all you find there is more machinery, more design, or apparent design, in need of reverse engineering. Nowhere are Mother Nature's hidden constraints written down in a way that can be read without the help of the interpretive rules of artifact hermeneutics. Dennett, 1990b. The descent to the deeper level of the DNA, for instance, is indeed a valuable way of vastly improving one's investigative acuity, though usually at the intolerable cost of drowning in too much data. But in any case, it is not an alternative to adaptationism. It is an extension of it. The example of playing chess with hidden constraints lets us see a profound difference between Mother Nature and human chess players that does have implications, I think, for a widespread foible in adaptationist thinking. If you were playing chess under hidden constraints, you would adjust your strategy accordingly. Knowing that you had secretly promised not to move your queen diagonally, you would probably forego any campaign that put your queen at risk of capture thanks to her unusual limitation. Although, of course, you could take a chance, hoping your weak opponent wouldn't notice the possibility. But you have knowledge of the hidden constraints and foresight. Mother Nature does not. Mother Nature has no reason to avoid high-risk gambits. She takes them all and shrugs when most of them lose. Here is how the idea applies in evolutionary thinking. Suppose we notice that a particular butterfly has protective coloration on its wings that uncannily mimics the pattern of colors on the forest floor where it lives. We chalk that up as a fine adaptation, camouflage, which it undoubtedly is. This butterfly does better than its cousins because its coloration so perfectly reproduces the coloration of the forest floor. But there is a temptation, routinely succumbed to add, implicitly or explicitly, "And what's more, if the forest floor had any other color pattern on it, the butterfly would look like that pattern instead." That is uncalled for. It may well not be true. It could even be, in the limit, that this is the only sort of forest floor that this lineage of butterfly could mimic with much success. If the forest floor were much different, this lineage would just not be here. Never forget about the importance in evolution of bait and switch. If the forest floor changes, what will happen? Will the butterfly automatically adapt? All we can say is that either it will adapt by changing its camouflage, or it won't. If it doesn't, then either it will find some other adaptation in its limited kit of available moves, or it will soon disappear. The limiting case, in which exactly one path was ever open to explore, is an instance of our old nemesis, actualism. Only the actual was possible. Such straight-jacketed explorations of the space of apparent possibility are not ruled out, I am saying, but they must be the exception, not the rule. If they were the rule, Darwinism would be defunct, utterly incapable of explaining any of the apparent design in the biosphere. It would be as if you wrote a chess-playing computer program that could just play one game by rote, say, Alioukhine's moves in the famous Flamberg-Alioukhine match in Mannheim in 1914, and, mirabile dictu, it regularly won against all competition. This would be a pre-established harmony of miraculous proportions, and would make a mockery of the Darwinian claim to have an explanation of how the winning moves have been found. But our dismissal of actualism should not tempt us to err in the other direction, supposing that the space of real possibilities is much more densely populated than it actually is. The temptation, when we think about phenotypic variation, is to adopt a sort of identikit tactic of assuming that all the minor variations we can imagine on the themes we find in actuality are truly available. Carried to extremes, this tactic will always vastly, capital V, vastly, overestimate what is actually possible. If the actual tree of life occupies vanishingly narrow threads through the library of Mendel, the actually possible tree of life is itself some rather bushier but still far from dense partial filling of the apparently possible. We have already seen that the vast space of all imaginable phenotypes, identikit space, we might call it, no doubt includes huge regions for which there are no recipes in the library of Mendel. But even along the paths through which the tree of life wanders, we are not guaranteed that the neighboring regions of identikit space are actually all accessible. If hidden constraints guarantee that there is a largely invisible set of maze walls, or channels, or railroad tracks in the space of apparent possibility, then "you can't get there from here" is true much more often than we might imagine. Even if this is so, we still can do no better in our exploration of this possibility than to play out our reverse engineering strategies at every opportunity, at every level. It is important not to overestimate the actual possibilities, but it is even more important not to underestimate them, an equally common foible, though not one that adaptationists typically manifest. Many adaptationist arguments are of the "if it's possible, it will happen" variety. Cheats will emerge to invade the saints, or an arms race will ensue until such and such a first-order adaptive stability is achieved, etc. These arguments presuppose that enough of the space of possibilities is habitable to ensure that the process approximates the game theory model used. But are these assumptions always appropriate? Will these bacteria mutate into a form that is resistant to our new vaccine? Not if we're lucky, but we're better off assuming the worst, namely that there are, in the space actually accessible to these bacteria, countermoves in the arms race our medical innovation has set in motion. Williams and Ness, 1991. Chapter 9. Adaptationism is both ubiquitous and powerful in biology. Like any other idea, it can be misused, but it is not a mistaken idea. It is, in fact, the irreplaceable core of Darwinian thinking. Gould and Lewontin's fabled refutation of adaptationism is an illusion, but they have raised everybody's consciousness about the risks of incautious thinking. Good adaptationistic thinking is always on the lookout for hidden constraints, and in fact is the best method for uncovering them. Chapter 10, the view of Darwinian thinking presented so far in this audiobook, has been challenged, repeatedly, by Stephen Jay Gould, whose influential writings have contributed to a seriously distorted picture of evolutionary biology among both laypeople and philosophers and scientists in other fields. Gould has announced several different revolutionary abridgments of orthodox Darwinism, but they all turn out to be false alarms. There is a pattern to be discerned in these campaigns. Gould, like eminent evolutionary thinkers before him, has been searching for skyhooks to limit the power of Darwin's dangerous idea. Chapter 10. Bully for Brontosaurus. 1. The Boy Who Cried Wolf. Scientists have power by virtue of the respect commanded by the discipline. We may therefore be sorely tempted to misuse that power in furthering a personal prejudice or social goal. Why not provide that extra oomph by extending the umbrella of science over a personal preference in ethics or politics? But we cannot, lest we lose the very respect that tempted us in the first place. Stephen Jay Gould, 1991b, pages 429 through 30. Many years ago, I saw a program on British television in which younger children were interviewed about Queen Elizabeth II. Their confident answers were charming. The Queen, it seems, spends a large part of the day vacuum cleaning Buckingham Palace, while wearing her crown, of course. She pulls the throne up to the telly when she is not occupied with affairs of state, and wears an apron over her ermine robes when she does the washing up. I realized then that the largely imaginary Queen Elizabeth II of these young children, what philosophers would call their intentional object, was in some regards a more potent and interesting object in the world than the actual woman. Intentional objects are the creatures of beliefs, and hence they play a more direct role in guiding or misguiding people's behavior than do the real objects they purport to be identical to. The gold in Fort Knox, for example, is less important than what is believed about it. And the Albert Einstein of myth is, like Santa Claus, much better known than the relatively dimly remembered historical fellow who was the primary source for the myth. This chapter is about another myth, Stephen Jay Gould, refuter of orthodox Darwinism. Over the years, Gould has mounted a series of attacks on aspects of contemporary neo-Darwinism, and although none of these attacks has proven to be more than a mild corrective to orthodoxy at best, their rhetorical impact on the outside world has been immense and distorting. This presents me with a problem that I cannot ignore or postpone. In my own work over the years, I have often appealed to evolutionary considerations, and have almost as often run into a curious current of resistance. My appeals to Darwinian reasoning have been bluntly rejected as discredited, out-of-date science by philosophers, psychologists, linguists, anthropologists, and others who have blithely informed me that I have got my biology all wrong. I haven't been doing my homework, because Steve Gould has shown that Darwinism isn't in such good shape after all. Indeed, it is close to extinction. That is a myth, but a very influential myth, even in the halls of science. I have tried in this audiobook to present an accurate account of evolutionary thinking, deflecting the listener from common misunderstandings, and defending the theory against ill-grounded objections. I have had a lot of expert help and advice, and so I am confident that I have succeeded. But the view of Darwinian thinking I have presented is quite at odds with the view made familiar to many by Gould. Surely, then, my view must be mistaken. After all, who knows better about Darwin and Darwinism than Gould? Americans are notoriously ill-informed about evolution. A recent Gallup poll, June 1993, discovered that 47% of adult Americans believe that Homo sapiens is a species created by God less than 10,000 years ago. But insofar as they know anything at all about the subject, it is probably due more to Gould than to anyone else. In the battle over the teaching of creation science in the schools, he has been a key witness for the defense of evolution in the court cases that continue to plague American education. For 20 years, his monthly column, This View of Life, in Natural History, has provided professional and amateur biologists with a steady stream of arresting insights, fascinating facts, and well-needed correctives to their thinking. In addition to his collections of these essays, in such volumes as Ever Since Darwin, 1977A, The Panda's Thumb, 1980A, Hen's Teeth and Horse's Toes, 1983B, The Flamingo's Smile, 1985, Bully for Brontosaurus, 1991B, and Eight Little Piggies, 1993D, and his technical publications on snails and paleontology, he has written a major theoretical book, Ontogeny and Phylogeny, 1977B, An Attack on IQ Testing, The Measure of Man, 1981, a book on the reinterpretation of the fauna of the Burgess Shale, Wonderful Life, 1989A, and numerous other articles on topics ranging from Bach to baseball, from the nature of time to the compromises of Jurassic Park. Most of this is simply wonderful, astonishingly erudite, the very model of a scientist who recognizes, as my high school physics teacher once said, that science, done right, is one of the humanities. The title of Gould's monthly column comes from Darwin, the closing sentence of Origin of Species. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that, whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed laws of gravity from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. Anybody as prolific and energetic as Gould would surely have an agenda beyond that of simply educating and delighting his fellow human beings about the Darwinian view of life. In fact, he has had numerous agendas. He has fought hard against prejudice, and particularly against the abuse of scientific research and scientific prestige by those who would clothe their political ideologies in the potent mantle of scientific respectability. It is important to recognize that Darwinism has always had an unfortunate power to attract the most unwelcome enthusiasts, demagogues, and psychopaths, and misanthropes, and other abusers of Darwin's dangerous idea. Gould has laid this sad story bare in dozens of tales about the social Darwinists, about unspeakable racists, and most poignantly about basically good people who got confused, seduced and abandoned, you might say, by one Darwinian siren or another. It is all too easy to run off half-cocked with some poorly understood version of Darwinian thinking, and Gould has made it a major part of his life's work to protect his hero from this sort of abuse. The irony is that his own strenuous efforts to protect Darwinism have sometimes backfired. Gould has been a defender of his own brand of Darwinism, but an ardent opponent of what he has called ultra-Darwinism or hyper-Darwinism. What is the difference? The uncompromising, no skyhooks allowed Darwinism I have presented is, by Gould's lights, hyper-Darwinism, an extremist view that needs overthrowing, since, in fact, it is, as I have said, quite orthodox neo-Darwinism. Gould's campaigns have had to take the form of calls for revolution. Time and again, Gould has announced from his bully pulpit to a fascinated world of onlookers that neo-Darwinism is dead, supplanted by a revolutionary new vision, still Darwinian, but overthrowing the establishment view. It hasn't happened. As Simon Conway Morris, one of the heroes of Gould's wonderful life, has said, his views have done much to stir the established orthodoxies, even if, when the dust settles, the edifice of evolutionary theory still looks little changed. Conway Morris, 1991, page 6. Gould is not the only evolutionist to succumb to the urge of overdramatization. Manfred Eigen and Stuart Kaufman, and there are others we haven't considered, have also styled themselves at first as radical heretics. Who wouldn't prefer one's contributions to be truly revolutionary? But whereas Eigen and Kaufman, as we have noted, have moderated their rhetoric in due course, Gould has gone from revolution to revolution. So far, his declarations of revolution have all been false alarms. But he has kept on trying, defying the moral of Aesop's fable about the boy who cried wolf. This has earned him not just a credibility problem among scientists, but also the animosity of some of his colleagues, who have felt the sting of what they consider to be undeserved public condemnation in the face of his influential campaigns. As Robert Wright, 1990, page 30, puts it, Gould is America's evolutionist laureate. If he has been systematically misleading Americans about what evolution is and what it means, that amounts to a lot of intellectual damage. Has he done this? Consider the following. If you believe, 1, that adaptationism has been refuted or relegated to a minor role in evolutionary biology, or 2, that since adaptationism is the central intellectual flaw of sociobiology, Gould, 1993a, page 319, sociobiology has been utterly discredited as a scientific discipline, or 3, that Gould and Eldridge's hypothesis of punctuated equilibrium overthrew orthodox neo-Darwinism, or 4, that Gould has shown that the fact of mass extinction refutes the extrapolationism that is the Achilles heel of orthodox neo-Darwinism, then what you believe is a falsehood. If you believe any of these propositions, you are, however, in very good company. Both numerous and intellectually distinguished company. Quine once said of a misguided critic of his work, "He reads with a broad brush." We are all apt to do this, especially when we try to construe in simple terms the take-home message of work outside our own field. We tend to read, with bold brushstrokes, what we want to find. Each of these four propositions express a verdict that is rather more decisive and radical than Gould may have intended. But together, they compose a message that is out there, in many quarters. I beg to differ, so it falls to me to dismantle the myth. Not an easy job, since I must painstakingly separate the rhetoric from the reality, all the while fending off, by explaining away, the entirely reasonable presumption that an evolutionist of Gould's stature couldn't be that wrong in his verdicts. Could he? Yes and no. The real Gould has made major contributions to evolutionary thinking, correcting a variety of serious and widespread misapprehensions. But the mythical Gould has been created out of the yearnings of many Darwin dreaders, feeding on Gould's highly charged words, and this has encouraged, in turn, his own aspirations to bring down ultra-Darwinism, leading him into some misbegotten claims. If Gould has kept crying wolf, why has he done this? The hypothesis I shall defend is that Gould is following in a long tradition of eminent thinkers who have been seeking skyhooks and coming up with cranes. Since evolutionary theory has made great progress in recent years, the task of making room for a skyhook has become more difficult, raising the bar for any thinker who wants to find some blessed exemption. By following the repetition of theme and variation in Gould's work, I will uncover a pattern. Each failed attempt defines a small portion of the shadow of his quarry, until eventually the source of Gould's driving discomfort will be clearly outlined. Gould's ultimate target is Darwin's dangerous idea itself. He is opposed to the very idea that evolution is, in the end, just an algorithmic process. It would be interesting to ask the further question of why Gould is so set against this idea, but that is really a task for another occasion, and perhaps for another writer. Gould himself has shown how to execute such a task. He has examined the underlying assumptions, fears, and hopes of earlier scientists, from Darwin himself through Alfred Binet, the inventor of IQ testing, to Charles Walcott, the misclassifier of the Burgess Shale fauna, to name just three of his best-known case histories. What hidden agendas, moral, political, religious, have driven Gould himself? Fascinating though this question is, I am going to resist the temptation to try to answer it, though in due course I will briefly consider, as I must, the rival hypotheses that have been suggested. I have enough to do just defending the admittedly startling claim that the pattern in Gould's failed revolutions reveals that America's evolutionist laureate has always been uncomfortable with the fundamental core of Darwinism. For years, I was genuinely baffled by the ill-defined hostility to Darwinism that I encountered among many of my fellow academics. And although they cited Gould as their authority, I figured they were just wishfully misreading him, with a little help from the mass media, always eager to obliterate subtlety and fan the flames of every minor controversy. It didn't really occur to me that Gould was often fighting on the other side. He himself has been victimized so often by this hostility. Maynard Smith mentions just one example. One cannot spend a lifetime working on evolutionary theory without becoming aware that most people who do not work in the field, and some who do, have a strong wish to believe that the Darwinian theory is false. This was most recently brought home to me when my friend Stephen Gould, who is as convinced a Darwinist as I am, found himself the occasion of an editorial in The Guardian announcing the death of Darwinism, followed by an extensive correspondence on the same theme, merely because he had pointed out some difficulties the theory still faces. Maynard Smith, 1981, page 221, as reprinted in Maynard Smith, 1988. Why should such a convinced Darwinist as Gould keep getting himself in trouble by contributing to the public misconception that Darwinism is dead? There is no more committed or brilliant adaptationist than John Maynard Smith. But here I think we see the master napping. He doesn't ask himself this why question. After I began to notice that many of the most important contributions to evolutionary theory have been made by thinkers who were fundamentally ill at ease with Darwin's great insight, I could begin to take seriously the hypothesis that Gould himself is one of these. Making the case for this hypothesis will take patience and hard work, but there's no avoiding it. The mythology about what Gould has shown and hasn't shown is so widespread that it will befog all the other issues before us, if I don't do what I can to disperse it first. 2. The Spandrel's Thumb. I think I can see what is breaking down in evolutionary theory. The strict construction of the modern synthesis with its belief in pervasive adaptation, gradualism and extrapolation by smooth continuity from causes of change in local populations to major trends and transitions in the history of life. Stephen J. Gould, 1980b. At issue is not the general idea that natural selection can act as a creative force. The basic argument, in principle, is sound. Primary doubt centers on the subsidiary claims, gradualism, and the adaptationist program. Stephen J. Gould, 1982a. Gould has done much to bring a central theme of Darwinism, that supposed perfection in design is a jury-rigged compromise, adopting some improbable pieces of anatomy, to general notice. But some of these essays contain hints that somehow the Darwinian explanation is only partly correct. But is this a serious attack? Not on a closer reading. Simon Conway Morris, 1991. Gould, 1980b, 1982a, sees two main problem elements in the modern synthesis, pervasive adaptation and gradualism, and he sees them as related. How? He has given somewhat different answers over the years. We can begin with pervasive adaptation. To see what the issue is, we should return to the Gould and Lewontin paper of 1979. The title is a good place to start. The Spandrels of San Marco and the Panglossian Paradigm, a critique of the adaptationist program. In addition to their redefining of Panglossian, they introduced another term, spandrel, which has proven to be a highly successful coinage in one sense. It has spread through evolutionary biology and beyond. In a recent retrospective essay, Gould put it this way. 10 years later, my friend Dave Ropp said to me, "We have all been spandrelized." When your example becomes both generic and a different part of speech, you have won. Call those San Marco spandrels Kleenex, Jell-O, and a most emphatically non-metaphorical Band-Aid. Gould, 1993a, page 325. Ever since Gould and Lewontin, evolutionists and many others have spoken of spandrels, thinking that they knew what they were talking about. What are spandrels? A good question. Gould wants to convince us that adaptation is not pervasive, so he needs to have a term for the presumably many biological features that are not adaptations. They are to be called spandrels. Spandrels are, things that aren't adaptations, whatever they are. Gould and Lewontin have shown us, haven't they, that spandrels are ubiquitous in the biosphere? Not so. Once we clear away the confusions about what the term might mean, we will see that either spandrels are not ubiquitous after all, or they are the normal basis for adaptations, and hence no abridgment at all of pervasive adaptation. Gould and Lewontin's paper begins with two famous architectural examples, and since a crucial misstep is made at the outset, we must look closely at the text. One of the effects of classic texts is that people misremember them, having read them hurriedly once. Even if you are familiar with this oft-reprinted beginning, I urge you to read it again, slowly, to see how the misstep happens right before your eyes. The great dome of St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice presents in its mosaic design a detailed iconography expressing the mainstays of Christian faith. Three circles of figures radiate out from a central image of Christ, angels, disciples, and virtues. Each circle is divided into quadrants, even though the dome itself is radially symmetrical in structure. Each quadrant meets one of the four spandrels in the arches below the dome. Spandrels, the tapering, triangular spaces formed by the intersection of two rounded arches at right angle, are necessary architectural byproducts of mounting a dome on rounded arches. Each spandrel contains a design admirably fitted into its tapering space. The design is so elaborate, harmonious, and purposeful that we are tempted to view it as the starting point of any analysis, as the cause, in some sense, of the surrounding architecture. But this would invert the proper path of analysis. The system begins with an architectural constraint, the necessary four spandrels and their tapering triangular form. They provide a space in which the mosaicists worked. They set the quadripartite symmetry of the dome above. Every fan-vaulted ceiling must have a series of open spaces. Along the midline of the vault, where the sides of the fans intersect between the pillars. Since the spaces must exist, they are often used for ingenious ornamental effect. In King's College Chapel in Cambridge, for example, the spaces contain bosses alternately embellished with the Tudor rose and portcullis. In a sense, this design represents an adaptation, but the architectural constraint is clearly primary. The spaces arise as a necessary byproduct of fan vaulting. Their appropriate use is a secondary effect. Anyone who tried to argue that the structure exists because the alternation of rose and portcullis makes so much sense in a Tudor chapel would be inviting the same ridicule that Voltaire heaped on Dr. Pangloss. Yet evolutionary biologists, in their tendency to focus exclusively on immediate adaptation to local conditions, do tend to ignore architectural constraints and perform just such an inversion of explanation. Gould, 1993A, pages 147 to 49. First, we should notice that from the outset, Gould and Lewontin invite us to contrast adaptationism with a concern for architectural necessity or constraint, as if the discovery of such constraints weren't an integral part of good adaptationist reasoning, as I have argued in the last two chapters. Now, perhaps we should stop right here and consider the possibility that Gould and Lewontin have been massively misunderstood, thanks to the misfiring rhetoric of this opening passage, rhetoric which they even correct somewhat in the last sentence quoted prior. Perhaps what Gould and Lewontin showed in 1979 is that we must all be better adaptationists. We should expand our reverse engineering perspective back onto the processes of R&D and embryological development, instead of focusing exclusively on immediate adaptation to local conditions. That, after all, is one of the main lessons of the last two chapters, and Gould and Lewontin could share the credit for drawing it to the attention of evolutionists. But almost everything else that Gould and Lewontin have said militates against this interpretation. They mean to oppose adaptationism, not enlarge it. They call for a pluralism in evolutionary biology, of which adaptationism is to be just one element, its influence diminished by the other elements, if not utterly suppressed. The spandrels of San Marco, we are told, are necessary architectural byproducts of mounting a dome on rounded arches. In what sense necessary? The standard assumption among biologists, I have asked, is that this is somehow a geometric necessity, and hence has nothing whatever to do with adaptationist cost-benefit calculations, since there is simply no choice to be made. As Gould and Lewontin, page 161, put it, spandrels must exist once a blueprint specifies that a dome shall rest on rounded arches. But is that true? It might appear at first as if there were no alternatives to smooth, tapering, triangular surfaces in between the dome and the four rounded arches. But there are, in fact, indefinitely many ways that those spaces could be filled with masonry, all of them about equal in structural soundness and ease of building. Here is the San Marco scheme, on the left, in the downloadable PDF, and two variations. The variations are both In a word, ugly. But that does not make them impossible. Here, there is a terminological confusion that seriously impedes decision. Does Figure 10.3 display three different sorts of spandrels? Or does it display a spandrel on the left and two ugly alternatives to spandrels? Like other specialists, art historians often indulge in both strict and loose usages for their terms. Strictly speaking, the tapering, roughly spherical surface illustrated in Figure 10.1, the sort of surface illustrated on the left in Figure 10.3, is called appendative, not a spandrel. Strictly speaking, spandrels are what remains of a wall once you punch an arch through it. But even that definition leaves room for confusion. In Figure 10.4, are we shown spandrels on the left and something else on the right? Or do pierced spandrels count as spandrels, strictly speaking? I don't know. Speaking more loosely, spandrels are places to be dealt with. And in that looser sense, the three variations in Figure 10.3 all count as spandrel varieties. Another variety of spandrel, in that sense, would be a squinch, shown in Figure 10.5 in your PDF. But sometimes art historians speak of spandrels when they are talking specifically about pendatives. In that sense, squinches are not types of spandrels, but rivals to spandrels. Now, why does all this matter? Because when Gould and Lewontin say that spandrels are necessary architectural byproducts, what they say is false. If they are using spandrel in the narrow sense, synonymous with pendative, and true only if we understand the term in the loose, all-inclusive sense. But in that sense of the term, spandrels are design problems, not features that might either be designed, adaptations, or not. Spandrels in the loose sense are indeed geometrically necessary in one regard. If you place a dome over four arches, you have what you might call an obligatory design opportunity. You have to put something there to hold up the dome, some shape or other. You decide which. But if we interpret spandrels as obligatory places for one adaptation or another, they are hardly a challenge to adaptationism. But is there, nevertheless, some other way in which spandrels, in the narrow sense, pendatives, truly are non-optional features of San Marco? That is what